Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 209. Why Buddhism Matters, Past, Present, and Future.
Why does Buddhism matter? Pretty broad topic, but I'm happy to address it. And of course, it means in particular, why does Buddhism matter to you? And you all are young Tibetan professionals and students who are setting out to represent yourselves and your families and your countries, really, because I guess a lot of you are either Americans or Canadians or Europeans, as well as primarily Tibetan, which, formally speaking, of course, you're not supposed to be. So it, even doing that is an act of bravery, an act of solidarity with an oppressed people who have been an unrepresented nation, actually, you are, having been taken over colonially by a colonial power. And why does Buddhism matter to you? What is the story? And of course, it matters to you initially because you are mostly Tibetan Buddhists. A Buddha, technically speaking, is a being who is present equally in past, present, and future. I know that's an inconceivability. But this is, of course, why it is interesting to be a Buddhist, or in a way, let's say, being exposed to the Buddhist sense of reality, the Buddhist vision of the nature of life. And either the Buddha was completely cracked, and all of us Buddhists are also equally cracked and crazy, which modern materialists do think about religious people, we have to admit. They think that, because they think the only thing that is real is temporary material reality. And actually, since the time of quantum physics in 1926, reached a certain point of sophistication, almost 100 years ago, they thought they knew what matter was. And now they don't even know that, but they still insist everything is matter. You know, because they saw it dissolve under analysis when they got down to observing it at the super micro level. Anyway, what we believe Buddha to have been, and logically you can argue that is a cogent belief, not a blind belief, a rationally arguable belief, not to be a fanatic, but is rationally arguable. We believe that a Buddha is a being who knows what reality is completely and thoroughly, not just the reality of the psyche, of the mind, and of himself as a person, but the reality of atoms, the reality of energies, the reality of the world as well, past, present, and future, you know, astronomical, geological, whatever it may be, every kind of reality. Social, human, that's what we believe a Buddha is. And therefore, to be a Buddhist is to have another kind of view of the nature of reality than the modern view. And it doesn't mean you can't interact effectively with the modern view. And it may mean that you can interact more effectively with your own reality, your psychological reality, and your emotional reality, and your moral reality, and your social reality. It may mean you may be more effective at that, actually. In fact, that's what Buddhists do believe, do think. And all of that is arguable. Now, Buddhism is called a world religion, and in some respects it is, if you only think of it as a belief system, which is how world religions are defined. But if you think of Buddhism more or additionally to being a belief system, to being an action system, and most importantly, an education system, then it is a matter of investigation to decide whether or not it is more effective or less effective than modern materialist education, the Buddhist education system. To judge by the behavior of our beloved holiness, the Dalai Lama, your special protector and your special patron, let us say, and my teacher, and also other great lamas who have been fully developed the Buddhist education system, to look at their example, it would be hard to imagine that they are not better educated to deal with life than someone like the president of the United States. This particular bad president makes it easy, but other presidents as well. It's hard to think that they are better prepared for life than he is, than His Holiness is, and or many other really wonderful teachers and lamas that we know who have actually used Buddhism or approached Buddhism as an education system, as a practice system, as a way of living rather than merely a way of believing. Okay? So therefore, you should, but anyway, so from at the ground level, you should know more about what Buddhism is. It matters to you because it's part of your culture as a Tibetan, and as Tibetans, and it's a very valuable culture. I'm particularly fascinated by it since my youth, since I was around 18, 19 years old, when I first began to discover Buddhism and then Tibetan Buddhism. I was originally interested in Indian Buddhism, of course, and Tibetans proudly preserve Indian Buddhism, and because it is something fascinating. It has amazing knowledge, amazing literature, amazing philosophical system, and most important, amazing scientific system. And I have done nothing but been satisfied by it and continue to be impressed by it and learn from it at 78 years of age, having studied it now for around 60 years in this life, maybe a little bit more than that in previous lives, or which might explain my affinity for it. And so it's important to you because of being Tibetans. And it's important to you because of being human beings as well, in that how to live your life, what is a good life, and how to use life, really. You know, the modern materialist thing would tell you that your studies have to do with equipping yourself to earn money, to have a job, to perform well in your job and be a success. And of course, there's no question of any concern for your future life. You're going to be finished with your life entirely when you die, according to materialism, because you do not have a mind. You do not have either a subtle mind, that is, that will go on from this body when it dies to another body. And also, which came to this body, thanks to the kindness of your parents from previous lives. The materialist will not accept that, even though there's a great deal of evidence for it. But dogmatically speaking, they cannot accept it, because dogmatically speaking, they only believe in matter, even though they have come to know that they don't know what that is. So that's on one level. Then as a human being, why does it matter? Well, if actually you are going to have a future life, and if the quality of that future life, whether you'll be a human, happy human again, whether you'll be in a good family, whether you'll be Tibetan or not Tibetan, even if you are human, whether you're going to be a well-endowed human with intelligence and sensitivity and physical capability, on a decent planet. All this sort of thing has to do with what you do now, according to the Buddhist view of life. And so, you know, just like you make decisions nowadays, planning for your elder age, you know, you might marry if you're not married, you might have children, you want to be prepared for that. That's the economic question, partly. Partly, who do you choose to marry? Where do you choose to live? What country? Those are things you all plan for your future of this life. And imagine if you have to think about the future of a future life. And then how do you navigate the future life? Well, Buddhism has a very interesting theory of biology, which is called karma. Karma is not fate. It is not a god. You know, that's, by the way, you know, as a religion, Buddhism also is different from theistic religions, monotheistic religions who believe in a creator god, an all-powerful being who controls your fate and destiny. When people think karma is a kind of fate, it's because they think it's a substitute for God. But actually, it isn't a substitute for God. The only substitute for an omnipotent God, in the case of Buddhism, is yourself. You are the deity who controls your future by how you behave and what you understand in your own lifetime. And of course, your friends are deities in a certain way. Your teachers are deities, your parents are deities, your society is, in the sense that all your interaction with all of them also connects to how you will be in the future and how you will relate to them in the future. So the biological theory of karma substitutes action and causality, which is very scientific and rational, you have to confess, for some sort of outside force like an omnipotent deity, or even a bunch of omnipotent deities in some other types of theisms. Now, that doesn't mean that Buddhism doesn't believe in gods. There are gods, Lhasa, you know, is place of gods in Buddhism, but none of them is omnipotent, and none of them controls you 100%. They can influence you. They're powerful, just like, you know, policemen and presidents and politicians can influence you, and family members and so on. It's not that they can influence you, and they powerfully even, but they are not omnipotent, and the greatest influence on your future is yourself.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallows. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part episode was originally recorded for the Tibetan Community of Canada in Toronto for their recent summer program for Tibetan young professionals. To learn more about the Tibetan community in Canada or in your local area, please visit the podcast description. We'll be sure to include links to tcc.org and other resources from Tibet House US on how you can connect with your local Tibetan community. The Tibet House website also has an extended set of resources on their website. Visit their website at tibethouse.us. So, as we heard in the first part of this week's episode, Professor Thurman gave a succinct and dynamic introduction to Buddha, Buddhism, and their connections to modern physics and quantum mechanics. To learn more about these topics in depth, look in the podcast description and we'll link to additional episodes. Also look in the podcast description, we'll list a video there from the Tibet House US Menla channel on YouTube that relates to this episode. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including Dasit tours around the world with Professor Thurman led by geographic expeditions, please visit Tibet House's website. Again, their URL is tibethouse.us. They're on most social media platforms, and we look forward to connecting with you online. Your monthly membership and your online participation help support the mission of Tibet House to present and to preserve Tibetan culture in the West. Music for the Bob Thurman Podcast is generously supplied by Tenzin Chogyal. To learn more about the work and music of Tenzin Chogyal, please visit his website at TenzinChogyal.com. And be sure to stay tuned for the end of this week's episode, where Gary Gok reads some great poetry by America's newest poet laureate. And now, back to the second half of this week's episode with Professor Thurman and poetry by Gary Gok.
You know, the word gewa in Tibetan, which is translated as virtue, is translated from Sanskrit kushala. Kushala in Sanskrit means virtue also, but it also means skill. And why does it mean skill, like being skillful, like tabla keva, you know, skillful in some sort of activity or method? And why does it mean skill? Because you're an evolutionary being, according to Buddhist biology. But what the causal process of your evolution is not just your genes, you know, although that's part of it, but your causal as a human being, you know, as an animal, but your causal process is connected to your actions, your evolutionary actions. And your evolutionary actions are not only your physical actions, and your verb, but they include your verbal actions, because those are ways in which you interact with other beings verbally, and also your mental actions, even though mental actions do not directly interact with other beings in anything other than a very subtle way. They do more coarsely or more grossly react with other beings by stimulating your verbal actions and your physical actions. And therefore, there are 10 paths of good actions, skillful actions, virtuous actions, and 10 paths of unskillful and vicious actions that will direct your evolution in either positive or negative ways. And therefore, skill means navigating in a positive way through action, interaction with the world, and action in general. And that is Buddhist biology. And which is quite fascinating, which, you know, the genes even are in a way determined by that, because you have the genes you have from your parents, because you chose to be born in their family, and you're attracted to them because of your actions and your thoughts as a previous animal, some kind of animal in a previous life, maybe human, maybe not human. And So this is the Buddhist biology that, you know, you should learn as a science, not just as a faith thing, but as a science. For example, what are the different ways of life? The worst way of being alive as a human social animal is to be utterly isolated from other humans, right? Like in American prisons, they have finally, some human rights people have proven that solitary isolation, solitary confinement, is a cruel and unusual punishment, because a human being completely cut off from relations with others suffers very deeply. And there are animal forms that are deeply suffering, deeply isolated, you know, that are live in some kind of shell or something, you know, or suffer worse because they're more helpless in interacting with their environment than others. And so, which is kind of amazing, but Buddha's biology is, like Darwin, Buddha noticed that humans are interactive and interconnected to other species of animals. And even not just by genetic connection, by personal connection, because every human being, given the beginninglessness of the Buddha's vision of the universe, every human being has been every other type of animal in previous lives, including gods and including beings in hells and also horrible situations, and including previous kinds of humans. And so this biology thing is really important to understand in case it's true. And Buddha certainly thought it was correct, although he was never a fanatic. And one thing about Buddhist science that is very modern, actually, is that Buddhist science is not dogmatic. It doesn't believe that if you have a theory, that it's an absolute theory. All theories about the way relative reality works are relative. And so you're always looking to improve them. And you're open to new evidence and so forth, which is how modern science is supposed to be. It's not supposed to be dogmatic, like everything is matter, that's a dogma. We will not consider the existence of a mind or a spirit in a human being. That's actually anti-scientific, that behavior on the part of modern scientific materialists, what we call. So now the ultimate way of being is to be a Buddha, according to Buddhism. And if you become a Buddha, you become a being who identifies completely with all other beings, and you sort of expand from being confined in a particular body even. It's very preposterous from the point of view of materialism, what a Buddha really is, but it's not that unbelievable given an infinity in time of development to go in one direction or another. For example, some of you young people might have been in love, what we call, where, or you might be parents in a family, and you might identify strongly with your children or with your loved ones. And therefore, in a way, you feel if some injury happens to one of them, you almost feel like it happened to you. So that shows that as a human, you have the ability to identify with other beings and feel they're kind of you in a way. Maybe not quite the same way as your own hand or arm, but quite close. And really, if you're really deeply empathetic with another being, you practically feel their pain, like not just like Bill Clinton did, but really viscerally feel it like a saint does, like a Buddha does. And so Buddha is defined as a being who was once human, like us, but who learned by expanding their sense of identification with others, by loving them, by feeling, by being empathetic with them, to identify with all other beings, actually, and even identify with inanimate objects and feel like a kind of giant cloud of awareness and sensitivity. Now, that's how a Buddha is defined. And that's and in order to do that and be such a loving being, meaning fully identifying with the happiness of others, wanting them to be happy, that's how loving is defined. And not just possessive or lusting, but loving, meaning wanting the beloved to be happy. And that's said to be, logically, the ultimate, optimal way of being. Because when you are like that, you are happy yourself. Because you feel this wonderful connection with other beings, and their happiness makes you happy. And since there are more of them, you get more happiness that way. It sounds a little strange, I understand. But that's how it's defined. And in a way, remember Buddha did announce in the Four Noble Truths, his basic, even original teaching, where he did acknowledge suffering, of course, but his most important discovery was not suffering. Everybody knows about suffering. Who bangs, stubs their toe, they know about it. But his most important discovery was Nirvana, the third Noble Truth, that it's possible to be free from suffering, to be fully released from it, to be fully happy, which doesn't just mean dead. Dead is not necessarily happy because you don't stay dead, according to Buddha's view, understanding and realization about the nature of life. Dead is just where you transition from one embodiment to another. And in doing so, if you get to a worse embodiment, you simply increase your suffering. And even the materialist promise of a non-future life, that is to say, becoming nothing at death, is only a promise of anesthesia. It's like the ultimate heroin addiction, where you just don't feel anything, and you don't know that you're there, and you don't miss that you ever were there. And so it's a kind of release that they, it's a kind of nirvana, that, a negative nirvana that they preach, you know, because people probably wouldn't accept their stupid idea that you're only a material body unless they promise them some liberation from the troubles of keeping a body, especially as you get old. And their liberation is just that you become nothing, like you bang, you know, you're dead. Stay dead, you know, don't have any future problems. But that's completely insane, because nothing is nothing. It's not a place you can go, which really upsets them. I like to argue with scientists sometimes, and I always ask them, they're only supposed to believe in what they discover, right? Scientists, they only accept matter because you bump into it. But who bumped into nothing? And how did they report that discovery? Obviously no one did. No one ever reported. So it's only blind faith that nothing can exist. And it's insane. It's a contradictory use of language even, that nothing can exist. Nirvana is not nothing. Buddha doesn't say you become nothing at nirvana. He did not say that. You become free of suffering is what you become, which is a conservative way of saying you become happy. So this is key. So as a human being, Buddhism is the one philosophical, scientific, religious, ethical teaching that says that the human being has the ability to be truly happy. They have to actually a little bit change themselves, overcome their self-centeredness, and overcome their indoctrination in less, realistic worldviews, and realize that it's most realistic that if you have this kind of sensitivity that we do, and we have pleasure in life, we do know that we've had good times, that, and you give an infinite future, that you should be able to have completely good times. It actually makes sense. You know, only if you only have a certain limited future, of course, it does not make sense, naturally. You can't be totally happy if you have a body that's very sensitive to pain, and there's a lot of pain around you, and you're only living a certain period of time, then obviously, and you can't change your body as well as change your mind, then it doesn't make sense. But Buddha says we do change our body, whether we like it or not, and we're here forever, whether we like it or not. Death and birth and death and birth and death and birth go on and on. And so the whole question then becomes how to ensure that this endless life that we are facing becomes a happy one and not remains periodically mostly unhappy. And whatever little happiness we have, we lose it right away. It's a happiness, it's called the suffering of change, as you know probably if you know some Buddhism. So therefore, if the ultimate way of being is to be this vast being that is just a cloud of happiness, a Buddha, you know, a blissful Sambhogakaya, a Longjujiku, you know, a body of enjoyment, then that's the way you should use your life, to move toward that. If not gain it completely right away, but at least move toward it. And you may have to do other things. You may sometimes have to just be normal, let's say, in whatever society you live. But your larger motive, your highest priority is to move toward that life form of being fully happy. Because not only does it you become happy, but you gain the ability to make others happy when you are like that. So, therefore, the evolutionary skill is how to connect well to the world around you, to become more and more able to identify with it and become a bigger and bigger and more successful type of being. Okay, so if that's the case, you don't connect well to other beings if you kill them. That is a way of disconnecting from them. You're saying, I don't care about you. I don't care if you have your body or not. I'm going to destroy it. And even if you think they have a soul or a subtle body, subtle mind that goes on, from the body. You're just depriving them of their body by killing them, and that's not a way of connecting with them. Whereas when you save another life, you kind of say, oh, well, I appreciate that you have your life and you have your body, and you connect to them. You know, there are things in cultures, if you save someone's life, that person becomes indebted to you for life. You become responsible for them for life. You get a kind of long-term connection with them. And if you take their life, of course, you disconnect from them. Although in a Buddhist view, they'll come back at you in another life angrily, where they won't know why, but instinctively they'll dislike you. Similarly, you won't steal their stuff. Take what they don't give you. And you'll give them stuff. And you'll enjoy them possessing things. So, you know, second skillful path is to give gifts and not to steal from others. So don't take life, but save life. Give gifts and don't steal things. And then sexuality is the third physical way of relating. And sexuality, of course, is when a human being who gets to enjoy sexuality more than other kinds of animals, because they're a little more sensitive than them, and they take more time. And don't laugh now. Don't be embarrassed. You just have to be aware of what animal sexuality is like, lower animal than human. It's really quite only functional, efficient, not really fun. And but humans can. And therefore, a human being in that sexual encounter tends to lose their sense of self-centeredness temporarily. And really, then it's called love. You know, they feel one with the other being, ideally. I mean, not always, depends on their skill. But to use that kind of sexual relationship in an abusive and harmful way, where you harm the other being just to have some sort of personal domination or personal temporary satisfaction and so forth, but to really make something harmful, either to ruin their social relationship, wreck their family, harm them physically, you know, rape and such things, you know. And so it's not just adultery. Sometimes you'll see it translated as sexual, just adultery. But it is not only that. That can be, in some societies, a type of harm done to another being, but and to other members of your own family. But sexual harmfulness is actually what the thing is, and therefore use sexuality only in a loving and careful and beneficial manner to benefit another being. That's a truly loving aspect of it. And so those three paths of skill and unskill, so whatever they are, those, you know, killing, stealing, and sexually abusing versus saving life, giving gifts, and sexual benefit, those are the three, or those are the way of evolving towards positive or negative forms of life, positive and negative judged in terms of expanding your sense of connectedness to life, to the life of others, life larger than your own personal life, or shutting down your personal life and being less connected to others. Similarly, verbally, to lie is to deprive another of what you know, and to enclose them, imprison them in a false reality, to speak divisively, and to create enmity between other beings, and as opposed to speaking diplomatically and peace and reconcilingly, where you make them enjoy each other, friends with each other, to speak harshly and abusively as opposed to speaking sweetly and beneficially, and then to speak meaninglessly as opposed to meaningfully, in such a way as to increase others' understanding. And those are four skillful and unskillful ways of being verbal, interacting with the world verbally, and therefore evolving positively or negatively through verbal action. And then mentally, it's being malicious and angry and vicious toward others, or being loving and friendly and kind and generous toward others, and friendly toward others, and having a positive outlook on them. That's the unskillful and the skillful, and being greedy and wanting their stuff and scheming how to get it away from them versus being detached from their things and generous and sharing your things mentally, you know, generous and detached. And finally, being confused and imposing some narrow view on the world or being realistic and open to the world and being learning about it and being confident with it and more connecting to it. So raw, what's called realistic versus unrealistic view of the life or belief or worldview. These are the three mental skillful and unskillful actions. And that's how you evolve toward Buddhahood, by using the skillful ones, and also toward greater life forms and better life forms. So those are really wonderful. And so you have a biological theory, in other words, that justifies ethical behavior. And ethical behavior definitely benefits your life, because you will be more happy with others, they will be more happy with you, you'll be more successful with them, and you'll be more knowledgeable about them and about the world, and therefore you'll be more successful. So that's a great thing about being, and that matters, how you behave ethically. And whether you feel it's something that's has a bit of enlightened self-interest for you, it benefits you. In other words, that gives you a stronger motive to be ethical. Not only does it benefit others, we often think being ethical is to be a martyr, self-sacrificing, and all that, and that there is a level of it that can be like that. But this basically, being ethical benefits the person who is ethical. Worst of all, it's like Dalai Lama, His Holiness says about compassion. He says, when you develop compassion for others, the first person who gets happier is not necessarily the others, but it's you, the one who feels compassion toward them. You feel better. And you might be able to eventually make them feel better, but help them relieve their suffering. But that's not necessarily the first benefit is to you yourself. So you can extend that kind of a insight of His Holiness to ethics, you know. Then second, so that's the ethical side. Then, of course, that ethical side connects also to the wisdom side, because meaningful speech and realistic worldview, all of that, and understanding other beings in a caring, loving way. So in the essence of being able to be ethical also has to do with your understanding of life, and that life is relational. Now, there's been a lot of talk about Buddha's view of reality, about emptiness, Dongbanyin, and about dangme, about selflessness, and this sort of high thing, considered high in Buddhism. But it's not that high, and it's not that complicated. It's actually rather simple. And it's something that everyone kind of knows, and you have the benefit of having the Buddha's scientific teachings to teach you that, if you take advantage of it, if it's part and parcel of your culture. And it doesn't really mean that things are nothing. Some modern Westerners wrongly think that emptiness means nothingness, the nothingness that the materialists believe in, which is a sign of being slightly insane, since it's not there. So how can you believe in something that isn't there? It's really blind faith, truly blind faith. And whereas emptiness means that all things lack any unrelational component within them. They're empty of any non-relational element, which just means that all things are totally interrelated. So actually, emptiness actually means relativity. It's the most modern of scientific theories. Everything is just totally interrelated. Everything about you is relative, interrelated. There's no essence of yourself that is unrelated to other things. Your Buddha essence, your Buddha nature, is your openness to utter relativity, which Buddha is. Buddha is a being who relates to everything, as I said. It's a being who has become identified with all, with an infinity of life. And so your Buddha nature is that openness of yours which enables you to relate to things. And so that's easy to understand, actually. And admit, because our ignorance or wrong view in Buddhism is actually a misunderstanding. It isn't just a failure to know something. It's a wrong knowing of something. And when I think like I'm the one, I'm the greatest, I'm Bob Thurman, I'm blah, 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 then I'm wrongly thinking like there's some Bob Thurman-ness inside me that is absolute thing, that's the real thing. And there's something relatively real that's Bob Thurman, a process, a continuation, physical, mental continuation. But there's no fixed thing that's unconnected to everything else that's always the same thing. That's a key delusion that ignorant human beings from Buddha's point of view, have, which is the source of all of our problems. And we erode that feeling bit by bit by emptiness, which means relationality. We begin to realize we're more and more related to everything. And this makes us more connected again, and is a kind of medicine for our sense of isolation and alienation and the problematic nature of being alive in the world. I'd say, why, as if we had a choice not to be. You know, even death doesn't get you out of life. It just shifts the mode of your life, you know. It's like sleeping. When you fall asleep, you're tired, sick and tired of being around that day. You're weary, you've done enough. And so you want to be unconscious. But that doesn't destroy you. You wake up again right away. You know, like subjectively speaking, all too soon, your alarm goes off and you have to get up, right? So there's no way to obliterate yourself by being nothing, because you're not nothing. And also you're not a fixed something disconnected from everything. You're a relational interrelated process of life, mind and body. Okay? And from Buddha, that's Buddha's science, you know. And so that's where wisdom comes in. And wisdom is also important, as well as and most important, and it's what actually underlies true ethics, is true a realization of relativity. Tenjin Dao Zhongwa, that means, you know, that means relativity. Tenjong, right? Praticca Samuppada, or Praticca Anuppada, actually, as they will say. But never mind. So, why Buddhism matters is final bottom line here, getting toward 45 minutes. Buddhism matters to any being, not as necessarily as a religion. Now, this is important. His Holiness is so great and so wise, and he has always said he doesn't want to convert people who are not Buddhist, but who are members of other religions. And even he includes scientific humanism in that, which I'm not as generous as him, but he does, and I think he's right. I'm just too, whatever, dogmatic about it. But he thinks that you can learn from Buddhist science and from Buddhist biology and Buddhist metaphysics, the metaphysics or the physics, really, of emptiness, and Buddhist psychology, how to manage your emotions and how to live a good life. But you don't need to become dogmatic ideology, you know, I'm a Buddhist, you know, because your family, your grandparents, if you're originally a non-Buddhist, they are not Buddhist. They're Christian or Jewish or Muslim or secular humanist or Taoist or Hindu or whatever it is. And it's better you remain culturally connected to your roots in that way, he thinks. And also he asks Christians and Muslims and Hindus and others, try to convert our Buddhists, you know, because their grandmothers are Buddhists. So just let's not have religious competition, but let's have scientific competition. Let's have psychological competition, biological competition, and physical physics competition to see what is more realistic way of viewing life. And he caters a little bit, and he's happy to show, like, well, we don't believe in Mount Meru anymore. You have your different astronomical system in Western astronomy, and we accept it. And to show his open-mindedness, he does that. I don't 100% agree, personally, because Mount Meru theory is not a flat Earth theory, it's a mountain theory instead of a planet. But, you know, it's naive in other ways, agreed, because Buddha, you know, was not the important thing for him to tackle people in his day, whatever their cosmological view was. What was important for him was to change society, to change their way of managing their life stream, and to change their education system. And eventually he knew they'd get around to astronomy, another view of astronomy. So anyway, but that's a side story. So my point is that Buddhism matters to you because reality matters to you. And your reality is your body, speech, and mind, not just your body. And it's not just your economy then, it's your spiritual development also, and which is your evolutionary development. And you're faced with multi-life, long-term evolution, realistically speaking, because there's no absolute that you can hide out in. You know, emptiness is not an absolute that you can stay in. emptiness is the nature of the relative, which you're stuck in. And in the relative, you're always having more and more changing experience. And if you reach the max in that, in a way you become infinite, what we say, completely open, which is what a Buddha is, then you can be completely happy in relativity and be a source of happiness for other beings, just as much as Buddha is, as all the Buddhas are, you know, infinite numbers of them that there have been because of the past being infinite. But unfortunately, there's infinite numbers of us, little less dumber ones. And luckily, they're there to help us, though. So that's why it matters. Matters to you as a Tibetan because it's part of your culture. Matters to you as a Buddhist, because that's your culture, to understand what your culture is, and also to understand that other religions and other reality worldviews, like sciences, were developed by people who had the interests of humanity at heart. They were kind, they were compassionate, they had a kind of vision of being connected. They thought that, you know, a particular God was omnipotent, which maybe that God told them that, and they believed it, and maybe they, if they had deeper insight, they realized that although very powerful, it's illogical that any being, if there was an omnipotent and compassionate being, that there would be any suffering in the world. That doesn't make sense. The Buddha never claims to have become omnipotent by being capable of helping us free ourselves from suffering. We have part of the power to do it, that's all. The Buddha's like a god in a way, in that he's way beyond us, but he's not omnipotent, and he didn't create our bad situation. And even there is a scripture in Buddhist sutra, a discourse of the Buddha, where the god of his time, that us most Indians thought was omnipotent, Brahma, that Tsangpa said to one of Buddha's disciples, I didn't create the world. I'm sorry, I'm not omnipotent. My reputation is not correct. I don't mind, and I want you and I want Buddha to tell human beings that I'm not omnipotent, because when they're happy, then they thank me for making them happy, and that's nice. I don't mind that. But when they have a really horrible suffering, they blame me. They think I'm omnipotent, so I'm creating their suffering, and that I'm not. That's what God said to Buddha, Brahma, you know, the god Brahma. So that, I think, is sort of why Buddhism matters to you as a Tibetan, as a Buddhist. And then as a human being, it matters to you so you can live a good human life. And a good human life means not only that you are successful in the economy, and, you know, in society, but you are successful spiritually, and you love life, you have a good life, and you love the good side of life, and you love other beings, and that therefore then they reciprocate by liking you, and then makes you happy. And so, you know, you can have a more happy life by being more realistic. And if you want to be more realistic, you should take the Buddhist sciences seriously. You know, Buddha is known for someone who understood the nature of reality. That made him a scientist. Scientists seek to understand reality. They don't just dogmatically preach that everything is matter and you can be fine just by dying, as the materialist scientists do because of their dogma about it. Of course, they do that because they're scared of a version of an omnipotent God that they had in the West, who practically doomed everybody to hell all the time. He was scaring them. The preachers were scaring them. You know, so they thought if they had a mind or a soul, they'd end up in hell. So they don't want to have such a mind and soul. They don't want to be the victim of such a mean God. And therefore they got into believing there is no such thing, which in a way gave them a kind of liberation. But they invented a lot of groovy, great things because of that, partly, and also some dangerous things. But the point is, it's just not logical that some omnipotent being created such a weird world. We're all creating it together. But Buddha luckily discovered that it's not a bad world, because we have the possibility of becoming fully happy by becoming enlightened, by becoming Buddhas ourselves. And we're all going to do it, actually. Because given an infinite period of time, we're all going to get sick of suffering. And finally, we're going to find a way out, and we're going to listen to the better scientists who have given us the method of escaping from that. And, there is competition among scientists. It's wrong to have competition among religions. Just each one see the cultural elements of it for what it is, and find the wisdom and compassion in each teaching and religion, and make the best of it, and learn from the Buddhist education system. This would be the ideal outcome. Actually, in Shambhala, if you're interested, it doesn't mean that even the prophecy of Shambhala that we Tibetan Buddhists have doesn't mean that everybody becomes a Buddhist. Everybody becomes happy. Everybody becomes wise. Everybody becomes compassionate, is the idea. And even the people who use religion the most fanatically and destructively, which includes some Buddhists, in fact, nowadays, and always on and off, you know, who don't act ethically, even though they are Buddhists. But Shambhala is a time when the learning system is so good, the education system is so good, that people of whatever religion do not interpret that religion as being justifying any kind of violence or any kind of destructiveness. That's the fact. That's the way the future golden age of Shambhala is described. It's not described as some sort of religious conversion of the world to Buddhism. Not at all. But that everyone comes to respect the Buddha as the greatest scientist that walked on Earth. Yes, that will be the case. Einstein will have to move over a little bit. A lot of great things he did. Okay?
Welcome to the Bob Thurman Podcast. I'm Gary Gach. I'm reading at the summer solstice upon the inauguration of the new poet laureate of these United States, Joy Harjo, who of the Muscogee tribe has written about colonization as follows. Who are we before and after the encounter? And how do we imagine ourselves with an integrity and freshness outside the sludge and despair of destruction? I am seven generations from Monahwi, who, with the rest of the Red Stick contingent, fought Andrew Jackson at the Battle of Horseshoe Bend in what is now known as Alabama. Our tribe was removed unlawfully from our homelands. Seven generations can live under one roof. That sense of time brings history close, within breathing distance. I call it ancestor time. Everything is a living being, even time, even words. This is a poem of hers entitled, Perhaps the World Ends Here. The world begins at a kitchen table, no matter what we must eat to live. The gifts of earth are brought and prepared, set on the table. So it has been since creation, and it will go on. We chase chickens or dogs away from it. Babies teethe at the corners. They scrape their knees under it. It is here that children are given instructions on what it means to be human. We make men at it. We make women. At this table, we gossip, recall enemies and the ghosts of lovers. Our dreams drink coffee with us as they put their arms around our children. They laugh with us at our poor falling down selves as we put ourselves back together once again at the table. This table has been a house in the rain, an umbrella in the sun. Wars have begun and ended at this table. It is a place to hide in the shadow of terror, a place to celebrate the terrible victory. We have given birth on this table and have prepared our parents for burial here. At this table, we sing with joy, with sorrow. We pray of suffering and remorse. We give thanks. Perhaps the world will end at the kitchen table while we are laughing and crying, eating of the last sweet bite. She's also written, I agree with Xi that most of what is created is beyond us, is from that source of utter creation, the creator or God. We are technicians here on earth, but also co-creators. I'm still amazed, and I still say, after writing poetry for all this time, and now music, that ultimately humans have a small hand in it. We serve it. We have to put ourselves in the way of it and get out of the way of ourselves. And we have to hone our craft so that the form in which we hold our poems, our songs in, attracts the best. I'm Gary Gough, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.